This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, welcome all. This is Scott Hollenbeck. I'm temporarily hosting this meeting of the ICANN RDAP Technical Study Group on Thursday, 21 February 2019. In terms of agenda, what do we have teed up, folks?
Hi, Scott. This is Aliza. I believe we were going to go back through any of the edits or additions that were made to the working draft outline document.
Okay. So I'm bringing up a copy of the document locally. Yes, if we could share that, please.
And I'll put the link in the chat for ease of reference.
All right. All right, so I know that I had one request for an edit that Andy made, to describe the concept of claims in a little bit more detail. Is there anyone else who had made some edits to the document since we last spoke on Tuesday?
This is Gavin. Yeah, I've made a few edits, and I would actually like to flag them up for discussion.
All right, so Gavin, we'll put you in the queue. Anyone else?
This is Tong Hui. I added one in the assumption, so marked with green. But it's like okay. Very trivial.
Okay, Tomofumi, we'll put you in the queue. It looks like Murray joined on the phone. I see a 415 number in. That sounds like Murray.
Sure does.
All right, so Tomofumi, why don't we start with you? Where's your edit, please?
It's on assumption number 5. It originally said all credentials must be protected in a reasonable way. And I just added to the end throughout its life cycle.
Okay. Any discussion, feedback, commentary on that change? Andy?
Yeah, I just I don't know if I want to object to that or not. I don't know what we can impose on the identity providers. So, I think it's a great thing to put in there, but I believe identity providers may, in my mind, if they already have a credentialing system, they already have whatever standards, and we're probably not going to be changing that. So we may want to be a little careful about the language because, those credentials may already be assigned by someone by an identity provider today, and who knows what their practices are behind it.
I see. Well, when it's compromised, right? I mean, it needs to be protected at any point, when it's stored, when it's distributed, when the user is holding it. I mean, this is probably common for any kind of credential. Unless it's like sent out through plain text and it's expected to be shared or compromised from the get going. So, it does say in a reasonable way.
Okay. I'm good.
Would it be okay? Yeah. Cool.
Okay, so we're good with that text as currently written then? Any objections? If not, going once, twice, done. Okay, Gavin, would you like to lead us through your edits, please?
Yeah, hi. One small caveat, which is that I'm currently mobile and I don't actually have the documents in front of me. I'm going to try and see if I can get them up to go through them. Basically, after last time's conversation, I had a number of action items on the section, my considerations for other stakeholders section, which I've been working through. One of them was splitting out service level agreements and making it explicit which service level agreement should be in place and who those should be applied to. And as I did that, I realized that there are some things there that I didn't really understand, didn't quite make sense to me at the time, I was doing the editing. And so I've highlighted them in yellow for discussion. So with a service level agreement, typically it's a sort of unidirectional thing. So party A will deliver a service to party B in accordance with the service level agreement. And if party A fails to deliver in accordance with the SLA, then party B has some force, some legal force to either compel party A to correct that misdelivery or to impose some sort of penalty on them. And so when trying to apply that model to the system we're proposing, we have a number of different parties all interacting with each other. It's kind of hard to work out, you know, who should be the subject of an SLA and who should be the beneficiary, as it were. So thinking about registries and registrars is pretty straightforward. So the registry operator entered into an agreement with ICANN. ICANN is essentially the beneficiary of the SLA because the ICANN can impose sanctions on a registry operator for failing to deliver on their service level agreement. So that's pretty straightforward and probably is also straightforward for a registrar as well, because it's likely to be that the registrar accreditation agreement is the vehicle by which registrars get subjected to an SLA. The question I had was, how about the identity providers and the authorizers? Who should be the beneficiary of the SLA to which they're subject? And I can't work out who it should be. Should it be that the users of the system are the beneficiaries, or should it be that ICANN is the beneficiary? If you have a situation where the user is, let's say, a European police officer or European police service, and the identity provider is Europol, does it really make sense for ICANN to be the beneficiary of an SLA with Europol? And does it make sense for Europol to be subject to an SLA imposed on it by ICANN? That's what I wanted to flag up as a possible issue, and maybe we can go through those individually and see what people think about the directionality of these SLAs and who the parties to them should be. And the other thing I want to say was, it was discussed on the call last time that registrars would be subject to an SLA. And I've taken that as an assumption in the edit I made to the document today. But actually, now I think about it, I want to understand, again, what the vehicle for that would be. Would that be an RAA amendment? Or would this be something separate and parallel, and therefore not something that can be imposed on the registrars? So maybe if Francisco can talk a little bit about that. So since registrars is the first one in the list, can we hear a little bit more about how registrars are going to be subject to an SLA? Hello?
Yeah, Francisco, I think that question is directed at you.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
So I thought I talked about this before. There is an ongoing discussion with contractor parties to define an SLA for the RDAP service. This is going in parallel with the discussions on the profiles, which the profile, by the way, is almost done. The SLA, there's still more work to be done, but the thought is that there will be an SLA for the RDAP service eventually in some shape or form.
So my question is, how would that have any legal force if it's neither an amendment to the RAA or a consensus policy?
So you're asking the legal vehicle to make this SLA happen?
Yeah, specifically just for registrars, because I think for the case of registries, it's much more straightforward, because the registry agreement already has an SLA for RDBS, and what we're doing is on the RDAP part, the deployment side is saying RDBS now covers RDAP as well as who is. But for the registrar,
right.
it seems to me that there needs to be some additional legal instrument.
Oh, so the registrars are in the same boat. They have already an SLA for RDDS service. And it's very similar to the SLA for the registries. For RDDS.
Okay, I guess my memory was wrong there. I wasn't aware that there was an SLA for registrars. Okay. So then I want to think about the SLAs on the other parties within the system. So the first one on the list is ICANN.org. So my questions on this were, who would ICANN.org enter into the SLA with? Would it be the users? And if it is with the users, how would it be enforced? I guess also the question is, how would it be monitored? What penalties would be imposed and who would be the beneficiary of them? Is this something that we just need to bump up to the policy group and say, these are the questions you need to answer, or is it something we want to try and actually answer ourselves? Any comments on that from other people in the group?
So, Gavin, this is Andy. I think we just should leave that as an open question. I don't think we can answer it, but I think it's just an open question.
And Scott here. I think I tend to agree with Andy here. It's reasonable to assume that, the SLAs need to be established, but I don't think we have an obligation, to note how that happens. Who needs to be held to them, how they are held to them, et cetera. So maybe, Gavin, the right thing to do here is simply note, as you say, registry operators are subject to an SLA, but, ICANN needs to consider establishing, SLAs with the other actors in the system or something like that.
Okay, yeah. But my question is it appropriate for ICANN to have an SLA with an identity provider? Is the identity provider providing a service to ICANN, or is it providing a service to the users?
Well, both.
Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Andy. As I said, I think they're actually providing a service to both, right? Remember, the identity provider is the entity that the relying party is going to have to query, to obtain information about, authentication and authorization information. So, if I'm going to be sending, HTTP requests to some entity, I'd certainly like to have, some obligation on their part for responsiveness. And similarly, now of course, I think that one, it's enforceable. The SLA between the identity provider and the end users may be a little bit harder to describe. But I mean, if I'm a user, I would think that I would want one, but perhaps that SLA is something to be negotiated within the community of interest, the users and the community that identity provider actually serves.
This is Murray. Can I get in the queue here on this point?
Sure, Murray. I see Steve Crocker's hand raised. Steve, I apologize for not noticing. So let's go with Steve and then Murray. And then Andy just raised his hand.
Sorry, I'm mute. Thank you. There was no delay in you noticing. Just to this question of who's responsible to whom, it seems to me that the user has a primary relationship with the identity provider, and the identity provider is providing service first and foremost to the user. And so if the identity provider is not responsive to a query from our system, then the issue is that the identity provider is falling down on its service to the user. That's the way I would parse this.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Andy, I noticed you dropped your hand.
You just said what I was going to say.
Okay, Murray?
On the general topic of SLAs, I'm worried that we might end up spending too much time thinking about something that, in fact, we can't stipulate. So I wonder if we can just enumerate the relationships perhaps that where any breakdown, like all the places in the system that if they break down because someone's not holding up their end of the bargain, the users are going to see some distinct impact. So we could enumerate a bunch of these things and then leave it to ICANN to figure out what they could reasonably enforce. So the identity providers are one thing. The contract holders are another thing. ICANN in the middle, if they're doing the brokering thing, rather than come up with what those might be, maybe we should just point out, here are the places where breakdowns would be critical, and those are the places where ICANN might want to create SLAs, and then we can just sort of be done with this. I don't know, though. I'm trying to punt this because this seems like it's a lot of stuff that we have very little say in fact, as a technical group. So I'm just trying to limit our scope a little bit.
Okay, that sounds reasonable. Gavin, do you have some thoughts here on, I see you have the note that you made yourself, but thoughts on then specific text to put here? Would it be helpful if Murray took a crack at doing some editing, or what would you prefer?
Yeah, I mean, if Murray has something, some wording that he thinks would be good, then I'm happy to take that on. But I think enumerating the relationships and explaining what the impact, or what the rationale for having SLA, is, because obviously, as you say, if parties are not fulfilling their obligations, then the system doesn't work. I think that's useful information. I could add that if Murray doesn't want to.
Okay.
I've been under-contributing. I'm happy to take a crack at that.
Well, that's much appreciated, Murray. Thank you.
Okay, Steve, I see you have a hand raised. Is that an old hand?
New hand. Thank you.
Okay.
I just wanted to note that Gavin sent a note about Tucows' experience with their gated access process and provided a lot of numbers and a lot of commentary. I read that very quickly, but I was very impressed with the content that they provided. And I think that a discussion about what happens if somebody doesn't respond properly or doesn't provide the right information, et cetera, is a separate discussion, which, as we kind of touched on here, we don't want to get too far into and want to leave it to ICANN and others to sort out. And I think that any in-depth discussion of that would be advised to read the Tucows material. Not so much that it's necessarily 100% accurate about the way things will be, but it's pretty informative about the kinds of issues that come up and what they've taken, the approach that they've taken on that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Steve.
This is Gavin. I just wanted to say on the issue of it was mentioned on the last call, and Steve just mentioned it just briefly to them. I have added a section on complaints. It's pretty rough. So if anyone has any thoughts on section on the mechanism handling of complaints, which is at the bottom of my section, then that'd be appreciated.
Yeah, okay, folks. Yeah, so this is a paragraph just before the conclusion. Folks, want to take a quick look at that and see if you have any comments? Okay, I'm not seeing any hands. Andy notes in chat, the paragraph sounds good. Let's see what Francisco is typing. Yes, please, let's show it in the room. Yvette or whomever is controlling the scrolling, could you please scroll down to the paragraph just before the conclusion? And a little bit more, so yeah, there we go. That's all of it. Thank you. Okay, I'm seeing multiple sounds good to me's in the chat room there, so let's assume this is good to go, barring people sleeping on it and changing their mind. Gavin, did you have any other edits you'd like to walk us through?
Nothing more, no. So one of the other action items I had was just to clarify any obligations on ICANN. Just to clarify that I was referring to ICANN.org, which I've done. I think that's pretty non-controversial. What I've done is just put the word org in front of, after the word ICANN. So yeah, I think that should make me pretty clear now.
Okay. Any concerns with that? Tomofubi, I see you have your hand up. Please.
Hello. This hand is not regarding what was just mentioned. It's about another new edit. On section
okay.
8.
Which one is that?
Information security requirements.
Okay, and you said it's a suggestion for a new edit?
Yes.
Okay,
Okay. Sorry.
No problem. Okay, so, Gavin, just circling back. Is that everything?
Yeah, everything for me, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Gavin. So then I think now then in the queue, this bumps it back to me and then to Tomofumi. So the edits I had responsibility for, Yvette or whomever, is it Yvette? Who's scrolling?
Yeah, Scott, it's me. It's
okay.
Yvette.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I just want to make sure I call out the right person. If you go to the prerequisites subsection under proposed solution, okay, that's very good. Right there is fine. All right, now the last paragraph before where it says processing steps was in the document before, you know, describing this notion of attributes that are associated with an identity, and Andy had suggested, you know, that we, you know, spell out a little bit more clearly, you know, what are claims and, you know, how they fit into the picture. So I added and modified this paragraph a bit to note that this thing that I had been describing as attributes, you know, trying to stick to terms that, you know, the layman might understand, are actually known as claims in an OAuth context, and that these claims are encoded in a data structure known as a token. So I wanted to try to bridge that particular gap because we do talk about tokens elsewhere in the document. I also wanted to make it very clear that there's a need for policy development here, you know, to determine what this set of attributes slash claims would need to be. And then we'd also have to have policy in place to determine, you know, which identity providers or how the identity providers assign attributes slash claims to individuals. So the text is as you see it right now. Anyone have any thoughts or concerns or comments? Tomofumi, is that a new hand or an old hand?
Old hand.
Okay. Andy?
Yeah, so I'm fine with the text as is. My comment from the last call was really about getting a little more technical detail. And maybe for the claims, that is good enough, because we're basically piggybacking on what is already specified in OAuth. But we have some other requirements that basically say, hey, we're going to do pseudo identifiers, and we're going to be passing these things to other places, which is not really spelled out here and probably requires at some point, and I'm not saying in this section or even now, but at some point, we do have to spell that stuff out. So that was really all I wanted to say on that.
Okay, so could I ask you to put a note in some appropriate place here to make sure we don't miss that thought?
Will do.
Thank you, Andy. I don't see any other hands up, so was there any other comment on this text?
Yeah, it's Maria. I'm unfortunately mobile only, so I have to shout whenever I want to put my hands up. But I have a quick point, and I apologize that I'm discussing a document I can't currently look at. But when we get to things like claims, attributes, tokens, and such, do we need, but maybe the document has it, but again, I can't see it, a glossary or a definition section, because things like token are going to get overloaded very quickly. And in terms of a claim, who's claiming what, right? So just some context for the layer here.
Folks, what do you think? Would a glossary or, you know, some type of description of the terms used in the document be helpful?
I'm putting a load on it for this. I volunteer to write it.
What a concept. Knock yourself out, Murray.
Right, Jody, say this to Jody. I think it would be great if we could have some type of glossary. I find that very helpful. Thanks, Murray.
Yeah, sure. I'm going to be quiet now before I take any more action items.
Okay, I see some chat from Tomofumi. I agree. Glossary is good. Andy, is that an old hand or a new hand?
It's a new hand. I basically agree that Murray should add in the glossary.
Okay, it's unanimous. Thank you, Murray.
All right, I'm going to add a definition for Andy then.
Very good. All right, then I think in terms of the edits we had teed up for discussion, that was the list, except for Tomofumi suggesting that he had another one to discuss. So, Tomofumi, could you talk to us? What do you have there?
In Section 8, I believe there was some discussion regarding expanding Section 8.
All right, and again, so which section are you talking about?
Oh, yeah, the 8 section has a Section 8. It is on page, let's see the page. It says Information Security Requirements. It's on the third page, page 3. I marked it in green. Yeah. Give me 1 second. On Section 8A, I added one sentence saying there are some frameworks like ISO 31000 or NIST SP 800-30. But do you think that these information will be useful as a guidance, or should it go to the appendix instead?
What do you think, folks? Andy?
I think they should go into an appendix, personally.
Okay.
Jody?
So, I'm just curious why not have them go here? I really don't want to die on this hill for this. I'm just curious, Andy.
Mostly because we're intermingling a lot of must should language here, and this is what it's recommended to use, which may be fine, but I kind of get a little concerned when we're mixing the uppercase must should language with lowercase must should language, and so that's one of the reasons. The other reason is that we may want to, if we put it into the appendix, we can further explain what these things are. We don't have to, you know, without just referencing them, which I think is a better idea.
Say, this is Jody again. I think that's great, Andy. Thanks for explaining. Could we put, if we're going to do that, can we put a footnote in here or something that says refer to appendix 1.2 or 1.3? Just because I wouldn't want to lose these ideas and have them just be in an appendix which nobody may read. Just as long as they're added as a some kind of note in here to say, please see appendix 1.1 or 1.2.
Yeah, I think a forward reference is a good idea.
Okay, Tomofumi, you got that?
Yes. And do I have time to write like a appendix section today? I'll try to send it out today. Could it be reviewed offline by any chance?
Sure.
Is the people okay with that?
Yeah. Well, send a note to the mailing list when you've got it there to let people know when there's something to look at, okay?
Yes, I'll do it today. I'm slow, but I'll try really hard today.
Okay. Jody, you still have a hand up. Is that related to this topic or an old hand? Thank you. All right. So, Andy, I'm looking at the chat. You have some comments in the proposed solution section for possible discussion. What do you have there, bud?
Yes. So this was on – does this thing give you page numbers? What page is it? So if you go to the RDAP query processing under the proposed solution section, Yeah, I don't know what page this is. Page 9. There we go. I was just, so I reread these sections, probably a little more hastily this morning than I would have liked. But, when I was basically asking some questions, so I noticed that, we're handing to the RDAP client an ID token and an access token. And I was kind of questioning the need to do both. I thought the RDAP client simply needed an access token. So that was one question. And the next question was, okay, so if we are doing that, if we are doing both, what's the mechanism here? What's the technical mechanism? Are these two different HTTP headers? How does that work? And then third was, what exactly are we passing to the contracted parties? Because we have some requirements to say we're passing information to the contracted parties, but we really haven't described how we're doing that or what we're doing. So that's my three comments.
Okay, so let's talk about that. From a protocol perspective, you're absolutely correct about the access token is required, the ID token is optional. All right? I've got them in there just, noting that, we haven't actually determined, from a protocol perspective, how or if that ID token might be usable or not. Rather than get into the detail of here of the work to be done yet in terms of protocol specification, I thought, well, spell it out. Maybe we say an optional ID token. Would that be better?
That's fine. If we want to make it optional, that's probably better to make it optional. I was really mostly I asked that question kind of because I asked the second question was, okay, if I'm passing these two things, how exactly does that work? So optional is fine. I'm really more curious about the technical mechanism, which, by the way, if you don't think we need to describe that here, if that's something for later work, I'm fine with that answer as well.
Yeah. Well, and indeed, I think that probably is, a little bit beyond what we want to get into here in terms of this document. But, since we are talking about it, the way it's specified in the draft is that they're passed as query parameters in the URL.
Okay.
All right. And then third question. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, getting back to the second question, when do you feel we should start specifying that? Or should we, do we have a reference to your draft in here? Maybe that's a better idea.
No, we don't yet. But you're right. So perhaps I can add a sentence someplace that just says, something along the lines of, current thinking is captured or this is a work in progress or something like that.
Yeah, and so that's probably good, and in fact, that's probably very good for the top of the proposed section to say, by the way, we didn't come up with this out of, thin air just for this. This work has been ongoing, and here's the draft in the
okay.
IETF where it's been discussed. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Cool.
Okay, I'll make that change.
And so then the third question is, what are we thinking about passing to the CP? And again, that may be more of a technical thing. That we don't describe here, but since we're discussing it.
Yeah. Yeah, so
if.
Sorry, I'm just kind of, what's the word here, captivating maybe a little bit. Mostly because, remember, the model here that we're talking about is the contracted party servers would receive queries from the general public for public data, all right, so they get nothing there. And in the channel from ICANN, it's normal RDAP, where we're suggesting that, client authentication be done with a digital certificate at the TLS layer level. Now, I remember when we met last week, we talked about the possibility of actually, adding some additional query parameters or something, again, it's somehow extending RDAP to deal with the need to pass additional information to the contracted party server. We haven't talked about that in detail yet, so I don't really have a specific proposal in mind yet.
But Can I make a recommendation?
Of course.
As opposed to trying to actually say whether it's like a query parameter or a header or something like that, I think we should just note that in the paragraph here somewhere that there is token and information will be passed to the contracted party to satisfy whatever our requirements are. And
okay.
Then we can come up with a solution later.
All right. Well, you are a named reviewer of this section. Could I ask you to just stick that sentence wherever you think it's appropriate?
Will do.
All right. Oh, look, I'm volunteering Andy for stuff. That feels good. Thank you. Okay, so let's see. We got all that squared away. You know, given Murray action items, I'm feeling good about this. All right. So I'm not seeing anything in the chat. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Are you going to Prague? God, I'll have to give you something here.
Yeah, I'll be there, but I'm not, now that you warned me, I'll be looking for you first. And I don't see any hands raised. Have we come to the end of our agenda for today?
Hi, Scott. It's Aliza. Yeah, as far as I know, this was what we were going to work on. So you may want to discuss how you want to tackle the further edits and the agenda for your next call, which will be on Tuesday.
Okay. So let's see if we can't recap some action items here in terms of edits that we agreed to. Let's go back. Tomofumi, it looks like you've been already making some changes in the document, but you are going to look at add some appendix text. Gavin, you are going to be making some modifications to the text that you proposed on the SLA section. Andy was going to stick a sentence into the RDAP or an appropriate place there, Andy, which he's already working on. Thank you. Murray had accepted some responsibility for coming up with our glossary or definitions section. Did I miss anybody?
Yeah, I think I also was going to suggest some stuff on the field of Gavin's contribution about SLA. I'll do that as well.
Okay, thank you.
And one point on some of the info sec stuff, if I may, just in the history of editing RFCs and that sort of thing, any requirements that we want to say about InfoSec definitely do not belong in an appendix. The IHF tends to say requirements stuff belongs to the body, and any kind of tutorial material or background material is ideal for appendix. And so I think that's an appropriate thing to do here as well, given the bounds of what this is going to look like in the end.
Okay, thank you. All right, so with those action items summarized, in terms of prep for our next call, what I'd like to suggest is that folks, as you get your edits completed, please send a little note off to the mailing list, letting folks know that you've made your changes, requesting review. And I'd like to ask that, the rest of the group, please then make an effort to go take a look at that text. Either engage in conversation on list if it's simple, or if you prefer, tee up some questions for conversation the next time we talk, which I believe is next Tuesday. Does that sound appropriate?
Can I make an invitation about the glossary? My intent is to go through the document top to bottom, and any term that I think either I don't get yet, I don't know exactly what a claim might mean in a law context, for example, but any term that I definitely don't get myself, or I believe that a layperson might need support to understand, if you can identify any of those things, please feel free to suggest them, and I'll include something about them as well. Otherwise, it's going to be done from the perspective of one person who already sort of understands half the material. I'd love more input on that.
Yeah, not a problem, Murray. Any place that you're looking for input, just add a comment or something in the text there, and, folks will make an attempt to fill in the gaps as we can.
Wilco.
So, Scott?
Andy, oh, sorry, yes, I see your hand raised. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to, so Murray just said something, of course, I didn't quite catch all of it. He said something about the security requirements, the information security requirements. being or not being in the appendix, and I want clarification on what his point was there.
So it sounded like, and I may have misunderstood, but it sounded like you were going to direct all the InfoSec stuff into an appendix. And I want to suggest that we tease out requirements. Those do not belong in an appendix. But supporting material, tutorials, that sort of stuff is perfectly great for an appendix. Like, often I've done documents where you say, this is required, this is required, this is optional, this is required. And then if you want to explain why those things are required, what they contribute, and you feel like that might be too verbose for the main body of the document, that might feel for an appendix.
Okay, so the text as I saw it, and Thomas Lee has probably already edited it, but the text as I saw it was, we said certain very specific standards were recommended and lowercase recommended. And so those weren't really what I consider hard and fast requirements. It was in language that had, you know, 2119 capitalized must should, but we said lowercase recommended. So I said, my comment was, that's fine. We should put that in an appendix where we can actually explain what it is. But if we're not going to make a hard and fast statement about, yes, they should be doing this, then that to me is not really a requirement.
Okay. So then I guess one other way to look at this is that the stuff that's in the main body of the document are things you need to either comply with or consider if you want to interoperate with other actors in the system. And then if you, for example, if TLS is required for authentication, then TLS should be in the main key. But if I don't know, there's some piece of it that is completely optional, then you can say this is optional, and for discussion about the optional stuff, go do it and go look at the appendix. So if the InfoSec stuff, if you were to not do any of it and you could still interoperate with the system, then yeah, sure, that could go off the appendix.
Yeah, I think if you're trying to make a case between normative and informative, as it stands, I believe what we're talking about is informative.
Okay.
Okay. Are you good with that then, Andy?
Yes, I am. I don't think we've changed anything, so.
Okay.
That's where we're
agreeing.
Okay, so does anyone else have anything else for today? If not, I think we have some action items and some assignments. We good to go?
Yep.
This is Aliza. I just wanted to let you all know what we should be posting that blog from Rom later today or at latest tomorrow about your face-to-face last week. So just FYI, I'll send an email to the list when it's up.
Great. Thank you, Aliza.
Sure thing.
Okay, folks, if there's nothing else, I think we're done. We could end the recording, and we'll get to our writing, and we'll have some conversation and be prepared for our conversation next Tuesday. Thank you, everybody.
Good job, everybody.